Evening. This is our fifth of our series of White House communications conversations with reporters and officials at the White House. And tonight we're pleased to have Dan Bartlett, who is the White House communications, I guess you could say, czar, because he has five offices that report to him that deal with communications in a variety of ways. The press office, which is responsible for daily information, the communications office, which looks at planning ahead and planning out events, media affairs, that deals with the regional and local press, global communications, and if I left one out?
Communications, you said?
Yeah, and the, yeah, communications. So.
And speech writing.
And speech writing, yeah. And speech writing also reports through him. And Dan comes to his job with a strong knowledge of the president. He worked for the president in when he was governor of Texas. He worked in the campaign. And he also has a sense not just of governing, but of campaigning, because he worked for Karl Rove. When you were in college, you worked for him.
I did.
Did you not? Yeah. And then went to work for him after he got out of college at the University of Texas. And so he's been able to bring both those worlds, an understanding of communications and politics, which has benefited him well in the in both campaigning and in the White House. And so he's is a perfect person to discuss, starting off, the difference in communications and campaigning and governing,
mm-hmm.
How you put it together, what the time frames are, and what sorts of things you're trying to get across when you're campaigning and then when you're governing.
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure to work with you, and Martha is a prominent fixture in the White House press operation, and is a great institutional knowledge of what has been done and what hasn't been done. We found out the hard way on a few things, and but I do appreciate the opportunity to come talk to you tonight. Communications in a campaign and communications while you're governing are fundamentally different, and quite frankly, it's much easier in the sense of campaigning, particularly as a challenger. It's because you don't have the burden of being the governor or being the president, in which your words carry much more, not as much more weight, but ramifications, because particularly in the job as president, you still represent the country around the world, particularly in foreign policy and these issues. It can raise some interesting challenges as far as how to structure and communicate. As I would view the limitations, or at least the fundamental difference, being communications in governance has much more long-term scope. You're trying to accomplish a goal, whether it be implementing a piece of legislation or affecting public opinion over a period of time, whether it be the tenure of your presidency, or whether maybe the tenure of the life of one piece of legislation, or the tenure of a year, State of the Union, you lay out goals, you work on those goals for a year. In a campaign, you really, while you have the horizon of until the election day, your communications goals are much more what I call the 3-meter target. They're right in front of you. And you really get into a point where you're trying to just win as many news cycles as possible. You're fighting or competing against your opponent, and you try to accumulate as many victories as possible in a given news cycle, and then hopefully the accumulation of those victories of news cycles build on each other and are telling a broader story. So I would say that is one of the more fundamental changes and differences. Although I will say, to back up a little bit and talk a little about communicating in the White House, one of the real challenges we found when we came into office, and looking, the best thing you can do when you're setting up your system of communications, or for any aspect of the White House, they don't give you a owner's manual. They don't say, this is how you do it, this is the right way to do it, that's the wrong way to do it. So what you try to do is look back over time and look at maybe some successful models or some not so successful models, So we did that. We looked back, basically going back to the, through the modern presidency, going back probably back to Nixon, and looked how they created, I believe it was Nixon who created the Office of Communications itself, and looked how they set up these different offices and the tactics they used, or the how many people they had staffed in various offices and the like. And really what we learned through this process was that it, because of the nature of the news cycle today, the 24-hour a day, 7 days a week news cycle, and particularly now with the global news cycle, that it really is not helping us. It didn't help us much to look that far back. In fact, I would say we learned the most from the Clinton administration, probably because they were the first to really deal with the news cycle as it is today, with the different types. I guess CNN really made its day in the Gulf War in 1991, but they really didn't even, Bush 41 didn't have to really deal with it in the sense that the Clinton administration did. We look back to Reagan, always viewed as a great communicator. Mike Deaver, very good, and somebody that we've tapped into and gotten a lot of good advice from. But their challenge was one shot, one picture a day on the three networks that always appeared on the evening news that night, 6:30, and the soundbite or two they were trying to get in the New York Times and the Washington Post for the most, and the LA Times or the USA Today for the most part. And that's what the news cycle was built upon. It was built upon that one 30-minute slot. Well, we have multiple storylines developing on an hourly basis in which we're always constantly dealing with, in which images have to constantly be fresh and innovative. We've got to continually be ahead of the news cycle, which in having three domestic-based cable channels, not to even mention the fact of Al Jazeera and others now dealing in, obviously, in the post-9/11 world and dealing in Afghanistan and Iraq and other places, the challenge we have of dealing with a news cycle that is 6 to 9 hours ahead of you, and with a different standard of reporting that we're even used to dealing with here. So, when we've set up and looked at ways to do this from a governance standpoint, we've had to learn a lot. You mentioned that we had the Office of Global Communications. That is something that we specifically created under this, in this administration, in the post 9/11 world, to try to deal with on an exclusive basis, kind of foreign audiences and how news is being delivered and how people are getting news overseas, with a particular focus on the Middle East and areas in which we were obviously heavily involved in, particularly Afghanistan. And the best example of that was in the early days of before military action started, but when it was imminent in Afghanistan. The Taliban, who was still in power at that time, had just a ragtag two-man operation, press operation, in which these guys would just on a daily basis go out there and make the most outrageous claims. Yet because they were 9 to 10 hours ahead of us, we woke up each morning. Despite how ridiculous the charge was, we still had to respond, so we were on defense right out of the gate. So what we did was, in not only in opening up the Office of Global Communications, we developed what was called coalition information centers, in which, in working with our counterparts in the British government, who did something similar during the Bosnia campaign, set up a multi-nation coalition information center in the region, in Islamabad, in order to deal with these in real time, and also from a reactive standpoint, but also proactively getting out our message. So we would have days which we would call a rolling news cycle. We would have our people in Islamabad start a communications initiative, whether it be on, for example, let's say talking about the oppression of women in Afghanistan, for example. Then we'd have, in Europe, we'd have a follow-up press conference later in the day in which maybe Tony Blair and his wife would do something to highlight this, and then it would roll to our news cycle, and then we'd have Mrs. Bush do the radio address, for example, as she did, to point out the oppression of women. So we started having to develop communications plans that transcended time zones like that, so we could be on the initiative, take the initiative, and not only wake up and have to deal with being on the defensive. So I say that just in the sense of setting up communications in the White House is has been a new phenomenon in the sense of dealing with the 24 hours news cycle. One thing I will say, how well I think we've departed somewhat in style from the Clinton administration for various reasons, is that I think if you look at the reputation of how we deal with communications and compare it to the way that the Clinton administration did, the best way I can describe it is to say that is put it in the stock market type analysis or analogy, and that would be they were more day traders and we were more kind of long-term investors. And what I mean by that is that the Clinton administration was very adept at and very engaged in trying to win every news cycle and jumping in every news cycle and fighting on that every news cycle. Now, in some cases, they didn't have a choice when they were under crisis communications in the sense that they had no other other point that they could do. But I think in general, they kind of had that mentality of winning every cycle, doing that in a way that may require them to be more nimble on what their message was going to be that day to kind of see where the current was going and jumping on that wave and riding it for the day or two or whatever. If that wave subsides, then jump on the next one. We have taken a different approach in a sense. Now, there are days when it's obvious in which you're going to have to play in a certain news cycle to deal with the news of the day. But what we feel is that particularly since there is so much competition and so much news content out there that it requires even more discipline to stay on message and stay what you want to talk about or you're not going to have success in getting anything across to the American people. So we have restrained ourselves from even sometimes when it looked like it might be to our advantage to jump on a news cycle if it was not fitting into our overall strategic communications plan to communicate a message on education or economy or whatever we were talking about for those 3 weeks or that month or for those 6 weeks. If it didn't quite fit in that construct, we may restrain ourselves from diving into that issue on a given news cycle, knowing that if we let the daily whims of the press corps take us in their direction, yeah, we may win five news cycles in a row, but if those five news cycles are on five different topics, at the end of the day, did anything really penetrate to the American people? Just because you got one headline or you got a snippet on the evening news or on CNN or MSNBC, did it have the ability to really penetrate? And I would argue that it probably didn't. So it requires us to show a level of discipline. Right now, as we enter into the general election campaign, I best way I describe it from a communication standpoint is we're coming out of spring training. We're trying to integrate and work with our campaign operation in the sense of who's going to respond to what. Is this mm-hmm. an official response? Is this a campaign response? How do we make sure that our campaign and the official White House is on the same message? We have conference calls every morning with them. I have a full team that we've picked and are over in the campaign office that are executing from a campaign message standpoint, which also includes obviously counteracting whatever is being said by the Democrat nominee. But we're still kind of working out the kinks of how that's going to work. There's some days in which the president is doing official events and campaign events. We're now having campaign press secretaries traveling with the official press secretary, is kind of handing off of the baton. And in this case, we are looking at precedent as well. We went back and looked at transcripts. Like, for example, when Mike McCurry was, in 1996, was the press secretary for President Clinton. Joe Lockhart was a campaign press spokesman. They both attended events and would brief the press simultaneously, or they'd hand off if it was a question on politics or whatever. And we're going to try to emulate that, but I would say that from an operational standpoint, we're still kind of working mm-hmm. to see how that's going to integrate from a messaging standpoint. Like I said, we'll be moving more from kind of long-term strategic communications goals more into a shorter time frame in which campaigns are really about chopping up into key segments and winning those daily news cycles.
When you look at the beginning of the Clinton administration, it was true that they were working on daily cycles. But if you go to the period, say in 97, once Congress went out of town, the president did a a 90-minute press conference in the State Department in which he was talking about his leadership, some specific things that they were interested in. And then they went, before the State of the Union, they were going through a series of initiatives that were going to be in the State of the Union, and they would take one each week so that they would highlight it during that period when Congress was out of town and there was nobody to present an alternate viewpoint. And then in that State of the Union, then the president presented what were going to be his initiatives during the year. And so they really did organize things in a way that was looking forward. One of the things they did, and Democrats generally tend to put a lot more attention into the press office and what information is coming out of there. And they did a lot of briefings, and those briefings tended to benefit them. Say if there was an economic report, they would have Gene Sperling come out and talk about it. You all have done some of it, but not very much. Like, for example, when Zelik came out and was talking about trade policy, he came out in the briefing room. And William Donaldson and Larry Thompson came out one day, too, when talking about SEC initiatives. And both of those are very successful.
And we did the National Drug Strategy recently, and John Walters, the head of the National Drug Policy, came and talked about that report.
And all of those tend to get you good publicity, and people have a sense through them of what your initiatives are, because they're people who are experts on the policy who can discuss them. Why do you do so few of them?
Maybe the most recent example was the head of our Council of Economic Advisors talking about outsourcing about an economic report, and it got a lot of attention, not the kind of attention we probably envisioned. Maybe that's a good reason why sometimes good intentions end up with opposite results. It is something that we could probably do a better job at. We are increasing the number of, even when there's not a report or something public coming out, the amount of education seminars or type of background meetings we've done, for example, in the National Security Council with numbers of our people who are in charge of certain areas of the world. So when an issue like Haiti or something pops to the forefront, some of the reporters may have had a briefing. We just did a briefing on Africa, for example, to give them an update of what's going on there. We're doing a briefing on the Middle East soon. And it just gives the time when there's not, it's not in the news at the day at the time, but gives some key background insights. So it's it is something that we, in hindsight, probably could have done more of. Now that we're in a very volatile kind of high-energy political climate, I think you saw what can be some of the downsides of it and what happened to Greg Mankiw.
When the economic report was being put together, were there people from the press operation or the communications operation that that worked with them on language?
Yes. It wasn't as much the language as it was the model. And what I was told when I looked at this was this, just to give a little bit of background, the Council of Economic Advisors every year does an economic report, and part of that report they do a statistical model in which they just put in a bunch of economic data of at the given moment with some assumptions that are being made in there, and it spits out an estimation of the amount of jobs that should be created based on that model. It's something the CAA has done for 23 years. Every year they put this model out. We did it for the first 3 years. First 3 years of our administration without any fanfare. We put it out this year, and it's taken with a much more different attitude because of the nature of this campaign and the nature of the debate that's before us right now. It was a lesson learned in the sense of it in the fact that it told us and told a lot of people who are not involved in the campaign but are involved in governance. It's a really one of the tricky intersections of where governance and campaigns can meet, and in some of the, there are a lot of upsides of being an incumbent. Don't get me wrong, and all things considered, I'd rather be an incumbent than a challenger. But having said that, there are limitations that present themselves, and that was obvious in that regard.
When you talk to people from earlier administrations, actually from if you look at the Eisenhower administration, Nixon, and Reagan, they all had very, very good communications operations. And one of the things they have in common is having to deal with new media, and say the Clinton one as well. So that Eisenhower actually had to deal with television. And all those administrations were able to take whatever the new technology was and made it work for them. Mm-hmm. And did they talk about how they did that, what challenges that they were presented with, and then how you could use that as a model, even though you were in a different position, there were different media, but you still were in a situation where it was volatile, the communications
business.
It
was interesting. I think probably the most common piece of advice we received from every administration, both Democrat and Republican, was don't ignore and, in fact, give more priority to local media than to the national media. To a T, whether it be the Clinton administration, Bush 41, Reagan administration, and going back, the single message I got more than anything else was, the real people, if you think about your mom or dad living somewhere in the country, they don't rush out and grab their New York Times. They rush out and grab their local paper. They don't always click on to the CBS Evening News. They click on to their local newscasters that they rely upon. And if you can reach them through the medium in which they typically trust more often, their local newscaster, the local paper, their local reporter, the better opportunity you're going to have to get your message across. And we've done that. We've spent a lot of time focusing on the regional media operation and local media operation because it is true. I think the biggest new thing that we had to deal with, the 24-hour news cycle is actually not new anymore, mm-hmm. has been probably the most new thing is dealing with the Internet mm-hmm. and how we're going to use the Internet from a communication standpoint. And we have the most interactive website, official White House website of any president. We've used some very creative, or we have a very creative person in my office, Jim Orr, who's done, like, for example, just wonders with the president's dog, of all things. I mean, he's taken this dog and has done Barney and mm-hmm. has done these videos and things like interactive videos, which drives people to the website. They'll watch the video, but then they may go click on something else and get part of the president's message. And we've done what's been called a series called Ask the White House, in which members of the administration and the White House will do an interactive Q&A with the public and just take in some incoming questions. And mm-hmm. so that's been kind of the new medium which we've really tried to tap into and utilize.
Do you know how that's working? For example, ask the White House, do you know how many hits there are and what do people learn from
it? I don't know off the top of my head, but we do get a lot of very positive feedback. You can tell by who the guest is, the level of interest. We get more interest from non-substantive people, and I say non-substantive in the sense that it's not – if they said Dan Bartlett's going to go in there and talk about the war in Iraq, we're going to get some very – obviously, people who are very energized on this issue on both sides who will come in. But we've found is like on days in which we'll put the White House chef on, we will get bombarded with people who are just mm-hmm. fascinated with, you know, what do you cook the president? And schools will participate, people, and mm-hmm. we will get fivefold the number of questions that will come in for somebody who, mm-hmm. the White House gardener, or we'll get somebody from the Secret Service to be on, or something like that. And people are interested in the presidency, not just the president. Mm-hmm. And that gives them a glimpse into the presidency and the White House. But what it has does, it gets us to draw them into the website, and then they're going to be exposed to the messages of the president as well. Mm-hmm. I would say that I think the Internet traffic doubled right after 9/11, but we have sustained growth. I don't know the exact number on it, but it's been double-digit growth mm-hmm. every quarter since then. And what my guys tell me when they say we need is the key to Internet communications is original content and interaction. Mm-hmm. If you have exclusive content on there like the Barney stuff, things where people can't get it elsewhere, it'll drive traffic, makes sense. And the other part is to have interaction and have interactive type of mm-hmm. communications.
In your point about putting attention on local coverage, I happened to be in College Station, Texas, when the energy proposal came out, and so I read the story in the College Station Eagle. And that story was written by Terry Hunt, Associated
the
Press
reporter,
and he's not, you know, what is he, about 100 yards from the Oval Office. So that even if you're dealing at the local level, that you still have to deal with the White House press corps.
Well, Terry Hunt makes that point to me almost on a daily basis that he has 1,600 papers that subscribe to their service, and he's right. I mean, the Associated Press, I think, is one of the, and Reuters and these wire services tend to be kind of the exception to some of the others. But I'm not saying that you can't give. It's not attention to regional at the expense of national, but give equal attention to. I don't think it has to be either or.
Mm-hmm. Mark McKinnon, who works for you all in the campaign, made an observation that the White House press corps had been lost in the dust of the internet and cable. Would you subscribe to that view?
No. The White House press corps may, on any given day, might not have influence or be the center of attention. And I think that was probably most on display during Iraqi freedom when the actual military operation went. They probably felt in their mind, I am at the best place in my career to be covering a war from the White House and giving context from here, which we all know the images and the commentary was dominated by the embeds who were actually in the field and giving original content exactly from the field. And it kind of changed the influence they may have on shaping or covering the news from that perspective. But I do think they control the storyline, which ebbs and flows throughout given news cycles. And they still have an incredible amount of influence, and it must be worked with and have access to and cooperate with. And that's if you want me to share that what we were talking about before.
Oh, sure, yeah.
This is one of the challenges. You're always looking for an environment in which your principal, the president for me in this case, can share his thoughts with reporters in a way that I think maximizes both the time of the reporters and the time of the president, in which they can get a sense of his thinking, get a sense of what he thinks is important. And sometimes if you do that on camera or if you do it in an on-the-record type format, just by human nature, you're going to be more cautious, you're going to be more you're going to think through your answers a little more. You have a public answer, it's going to be a little bit different than way you may do in a private conversation. So recently we've been working to set up some deep background, and deep background means the rule with the press is it can't be used for attribution. You can report it as fact or through sources, but you can't say who the source is, because in this fact it was the president. So we brought in the correspondents covering ABC News, NBC, CBS, CNN, and Fox to come in on a deep background basis with the president so the president could share his views, and this was last week, in order to give them a sense of what he was talking about and thinking about. It's supposed to be a half-hour session that went an hour long. The president talked about a wide range of issues, and both foreign and domestic, and opened it up to questions, took dozens of or so questions from the press on any topic of their interest. And the president really was in a very expansive environment, which I thought was very helpful, and they said was very helpful for their thinking. It didn't contain a lot of things that they could rush out to the front lawn and use as a hard news event, but what it gave them is some context to a lot of different issues in case they did come up, whether it be North Korea or this or that, and they'd had some background information from the president that could illuminate their thinking and help enrich their reporting. Well, what happened, because they work in such a competitive environment, none of these guys or women can do anything without the other ones knowing. So, and they all live on top of each other down there in the lower press office. And so when Scott McClellan, the White House press secretary, called them up, people took notice that all these, the network guys and cable guys, were going up to see to Scott's office. Scott, and I told Scott, I said, you better make sure to tell him there's nothing happening, that there's no big news event, that the president want to meet with them, not any specific matter, but just to have a general conversation. Well, they all went back before we went in to call their desks and tell them this. Well, so they call the desk, and the desk talks to a reporter, and this reporter talks to that reporter. By this time, despite the fact that we told them nothing was going on, ABC News was convinced that we had captured Osama bin Laden. There's been a lot of rumors about just that we were close to catching him and all this, and they were convinced, despite the fact that we told them flat out that this wasn't the case. So we were in the Oval Office having the meeting, and I learned afterwards, George Stephanopoulos, Brian Ross, who's the investigative reporter for ABC News, and Peter Jennings were literally in their seats in New York on the set waiting for their correspondent to come out to confirm, thinking that we're going to announce bin Laden was captured. We're in the meeting. John Roberts, who's the correspondent for CBS News, starts getting buzzed on his BlackBerry, and, you know, it's kind of distracting in the middle of the conversation with the president. His, like, BlackBerry's just buzzing away around the phone. I was like, just answer the thing. Do something. And he grabs it, and, you know, all these networks have sources in their competitors' areas. So he says, we're learning that ABC News is about to report you've captured Osama bin Laden. So he asked the president, he said, have we captured Osama bin Laden? And he's like, the president's like, you think I'd be sitting here with you if we captured bin Laden? No. So, you know, that happened. And then the Washington Post, who was not involved in this, decided that despite the fact that this was a deep background conversation that they were not involved in, since they knew it took place and picked up through scuttlebutt and other ways what had happened in there, they reported it as a news story the next day, attributing it to the president, some of the things that were said, and who was involved in it. And before they wrote it that night, both Scott and myself complained to the Post, complained to his editor, who wrote the story, who was overseeing the story, saying that this was going to hinder our ability to do this in the future, and it would actually influence our decision as to whether the Washington Post would be able to participate in that. If you can't abide by the ground rules and recognize those ground rules, then that has to influence our thinking when we do this in the future. They took that into consideration and decided to report it anyways. But what Martha was telling me is that this is a time-honored tradition and problem.
And a story I didn't tell you, but in 1898, after the sinking of the Maine, there was an investigation, and AP got a copy of the report that the commission was going to release. And the guy who was the secretary, who was basically the chief of staff, demanded a retraction because he said that they had to have gotten that from a White House copy, which was in a safe, and that therefore it must have been basically a stolen item. And so he wanted a retraction. So what they ended up doing was they went to the safe, and George Cordelier, who was the deputy, had sewn the, I guess it's some kind of cloth around it before they put it in the safe. And so when they saw that it was still intact, then the White House had to admit that he hadn't gotten, the AP hadn't gotten that copy, and therefore they had no power to stop them.
Huh.
And so there was no retraction about it. But it has been an issue. It was an issue in the Clinton administration. If the president makes news, then...
Right.
You know, it's going to get out because all those people who have been in there are going to talk to people. But there have been instances, say when he was on Air Force One, mm-hmm. coming back from the Middle East and coming back from Asia, he did sessions.
He did.
Which were...
on the record.
On the record. But they also, did they have sessions, did some of it extend over after the on-the-record session ended?
It did.
And those, nothing has come out about those.
For the most part, those,
yeah.
You're right, remained confidential. And even in the sense that those who, in the meeting last week, who did everything they can to honor the tradition and the agreement, still had trouble reporting it because they said, for example, I remember David Gregory, NBC News, goes mm-hmm. out and he says, the president has told aides XYZ. And I took issue with that because you're still attributing it to the president. And if it's on deep background and you can't attribute the source, just because you say he's telling it to the aide still attributes to the president. And mm-hmm. we went round and round on that, whether that was in violation or in honor of the agreement. And it all, what I'm trying to say is that it's there's a constant tension. And but I know we could probably do a better job of it. I've said that before. And we're constantly looking for ways to improve upon it, because my strategic goal as communications director for the president, and what I think is in the president's best interest, is the more reporters are covering the person and not the institution, the White House, I think is better for us from a communication standpoint. The more the reporter can get to know and personally understand and know the president and doesn't view this more as, I'm at the White House covering the White House, I'm totally detached from this, totally detached and devoid of any human relationship really with the president, I think will doesn't serve the president well in the fact of how he'll be covered. And my example on that is that in 1999-2000, we had a core group of reporters who had been assigned to the campaign since the very first days of the campaign. And they spent a lot of time with the president, interacted with the president when he was running. But the further we got along, even in the campaign for that matter, the more and more the press corps grew in size, and the more type of restrictions or standards. The president used to like walk on to the back of the plane and have off-the-record conversations with him. Well, at some point they decided mm-hmm. that can no longer be. If he walks back there, it has to be on the record. So the president said, fine. And he just didn't go back there anymore, which I don't think in the long run served them as well, because they didn't get to have this interaction. What got allowed them to know him better and get to know him as a person. Those people who did get to know him came to the White House, worked in the White House, but many of them have now rotated out and new people have rotated in. And quite frankly, a good chunk of them don't really know the president personally, which I'm at fault for that. I'm not to say that it could be rectified in some ways, but the environment we work in and the president's schedule, there's just not enough time in the day to just line up reporters at the door and just get to know sessions. So we try to find opportunities for them to interact with him and get to know him as a person, because I think when you communicate, one of his strengths is his personality, and when people get to know him, there's perceptions. I don't have to mm-hmm. rattle off the perceptions about my boss, and they're pretty well known, that he can't walk and chew gum and all these things, and I know that, and he's the best person to knock those type of myths down himself, mm-hmm. and so exposing him to the reporters, I think, is in our advantage, and I'm trying to find ways to do that, and this session last yeah. week was an attempt to do that.
But it's still, I mean, it still worked for you. Mm-hmm. I mean, even though if it became
it
public.
Did. No, it did.
But the ones on the plane worked well. And there you had a pool of reporters. So it wasn't like you're taking television, just television.
Well, there's a big difference
the
there.
Other day.
The big difference, and the reason that is when you do bring a pool in, they represent, I'm sure mm-hmm. they know what the pool is, they represent all the media. They have an obligation to take all of that and share it and repeat it for the rest of the media so everybody could use it. If you don't use a pool and you just bring in select reporters, they don't have to share that with the other
yeah.
reporters, which is a different,
right,
requires
yeah.
a different, it makes for a different dynamic.
Yeah.
And when they're not being a dutiful reporter who's there to represent the broader media, mm-hmm. they're there to represent their individual news organizations,
right. yeah.
which
that's
makes
true.
A difference.
Yeah, that's true. When you're thinking about the press, particularly when you were coming in to office, what role did you see the press as having? For example, did you see the press as a surrogate for the public? A view the press has that of itself.
This is always the difficult part for mostly for a press secretary, because a press secretary mm-hmm. is there to represent the president, and he's also there as a public servant working to accommodate the press's right to know things.
Mm-hmm.
And he has two clients, and there's always a balance of how you manage those two clients. My job, and before I oversaw all that, I was head of just the communications office, in which I'm planning strategic communications. My job is to try to get the message out the president's trying to convey to the public. And there are various ways to do that, including the press.
Mm-hmm.
We recognize they have a job, we have a job. There are going to be times in which it's in our mutual interest, and there's going to be times when there's going to be competing interests. I don't think it was adversarial as far as a view, an adversarial mm-hmm. view. There was a sense that things that the National Press Corps are interested in or think is news is much different than what mm-hmm. the public think is news or what they're interested in. They tend to be more focused on process and politics, who's up, who's down,
mm-hmm.
you know, those type things in which most Americans probably just want to know, how's this going to impact me? Why are you doing this? You know, what are the practical ramifications of it? So there's always those tensions or balances mm-hmm. or competing interests at times. But we didn't come in with a notion of knowing how it was going to happen or how we could, you know, go around them, uh-huh. go above them, go through them or anything like that. We knew that we're going to have to work with them.
Mm-hmm. Are there things that that you all learn from the press? That's information about how programs might work. Like, for example, I remember the president came out, it was on a day of a press conference he did in the briefing room,
mm-hmm.
and he was talking about, having read the paper that morning, that there was a story about how the hijackers, who were by then, it was some while after September 11th, that they had been granted flight school, the mm-hmm. permission to mm-hmm. come here for flight school. And so the president was very, very upset about it, obviously. And he said that he had learned that from reading a story in the Washington
right.
Post. And I was wondering what kinds of things that you have learned from reading the
every
press.
Day. One thing you learn when it is a big government and you don't have a clue of what all is going on and who's talking to who. And I learn every day I pick up the paper. Unfortunately, I learn about things
uh-huh.
I thought I knew. I mean, right now, right before I came over here, I have, at the end of the day, myself, the press secretary, Scott McClellan, we sit down with the chief of staff and deputy chief of staff, and we kind of do a wrap-up day of kind of mm-hmm. what's going on, what we're trying to anticipate will be on the network news, as well as what's going to be in the papers the next day. We typically capture we think we know everything is going to be captured. We probably get 30 or 40% of it, and the rest are things that we had no idea that was going to be broken or be reported on or whatever. And then, so you're dealing the next day with mm-hmm. potatoes that are put in your sack there, and you're dealing with them. But no, there have been a lot of very good reports or news investigative stories or different types of reporting, particularly overseas or in theater
uh-huh.
and things like that, that have been very helpful or shine a light on something that we didn't know about and has given us opportunity to address.
Mm-hmm. In looking,
well, I will say to that, I think one of the best, another medium in which we get immediate feedback and learn is talk radio. And it's, while it does tend to, attract the extremes on both sides of issues or of parties, I view it as a very good medium to see what works as far as communications. If there are lines or things we're trying to work, I can go on a talk radio program or something else, and I can get instant feedback as to whether it works or not.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another medium which we use often.
Yes, you put together two events on the North Lawn of the White House
yeah.
where you had tents and set up for talk radio people. How did those end up working for you?
They were extremely successful. What we did was have talk radio day on the White House lawn, in which we invited radio talk show hosts from all persuasions from around the country to come there, you know, with the enticement of saying, if you come, we will give you access to the highest ranking officials
mm-hmm.
in the administration, in which we had Secretary Powell, Secretary Rumsfeld, Dr. Rice, all the cabinet secretaries across the board. I think all but like two participated. The vice president
mm-hmm.
participated. Members of the senior staff did as well. And it gave an opportunity for a large swath of the public who listens to talk radio to hear an interesting conversation and interview. You know, they didn't pull any punches. They threw out questions we get from other. It's just a different type of interview. The cabinet secretaries, I got positive feedback from them. And then I spoke to the Broadcaster Association. They had a whole conference in last week, and I went to speak to them, and I probably got 50 different talk show hosts who came up afterwards wanting to participate in the next one because they'd heard about the success of it, and it really has been a successful venue.
How do you judge success of your various publicity operations? Like, say, for example, on the talk radio days, how do you know whether it's successful or not?
Well, we have a very vast network of supporters, for one thing, who are, particularly as you go into a campaign season, who are monitoring news for you, monitoring local markets. Congressmen, they are sometimes at the front lines of knowing what they're hearing in their districts and things like that, and they'll call and say, wow, we got a lot of positive feedback from that. We are monitoring the calls as well, the formats. We have people who oversee that. So, for example, the total number, you can just add up the number of news program radio shows that were there and say, and we know there are numbers. So anywhere from, if a radio program gets anywhere from, you know, like Sean Hannity, who gets in the millions, to NPR, who gets, you know, hundreds, tens of thousands or whatever at any given moment, depending on the program, and you add them all up, you say, okay, on this day, we at least reach 20 million people or 30 million people. That alone to us is a way to gauge success. Then you see the ripple effect. And what we found is the people who do radio for us and monitor these programs for us and interact with these people saw the long-term benefit because the program after, you know, four programs afterwards, they were still referring to, well, when I interviewed Secretary Powell, he said this, or I interviewed that. So it had a lasting benefit as well because it enriched their knowledge of what's going on and the issues and gave them, so I think it had a lasting value as well.
What about some of the daily events that you have? Like, say, an event in the East Room where the president speaks on a particular subject.
We get, I get clips from around the country, national clips, all the network coverage, transcripts, White House comment line, people calling in or emailing in. I get summaries of those. So we try to look at all the different venues and outputs and determine if it punched through or not to a certain level, editorial support or lack thereof. So over the course of a week, at the end of the week, I'll get a summary of what's in the news and local regional, key regional papers. I can't see all of them, but they'll give you the key regional papers, what they covered for that week and what they what got through or not. So we do have mechanisms in place to help keep us informed of what's going on.
One of the challenges seems to be, both in the Clinton years and in yours, that the public has a lot of different things that they're interested in other than politics, although after September 11th that has been somewhat different, but that it's hard to get to people to get them to listen. Have you all found that? And what kinds of strategies do you develop through?
Using unconventional media, I guess, is the best word for it. But it's you'll do interviews for news publications that don't typically cover politics. The president, for example, is an avid fisherman, so we'll have him sit down with Bassmaster or Field and Stream and have him do a conversation with them. So you're somebody who doesn't pick up the paper or pick up their magazine to know about politics but want to know about the president, it gets them away. For example, in our media campaign or our television advertising, we're running our ads on the Golf Channel, which is not the first place you would think to run. You think it's CNN or something or the local network, but we found for the demographics we're looking at that this was both an efficient from a spending standpoint and a target audience. An effective way of getting a non-traditional political audience. So we're always looking for ways to, like I said, the Barney cam, for example, is another example of that, where you're trying to take an unconventional way of getting people's attention. It drives them to the website, and then they might say, oh, well, I wonder what he's saying about education, and then they might click on something next to where the Barney video is or whatever it may be. So we're constantly looking at different ways. For example, about a couple months ago, we brought in we call it the hook and bullet crowd, which is the publications of all the hunting magazines, fishing magazines, conservation magazines. which reached millions of Americans. And we brought them in and did a roundtable with the president. The president gave his views on what's going on in conservation, and they got to ask questions about wetland policy and other things that are of interest to them. So you try to hit those target audiences that way as well.
So do you look mostly for whether you're getting through and what they understand about what the president is doing, rather than trying to persuade them? You're trying to get to them and assume that, you know, once you get to them with your message, that they will be persuaded.
Well, obviously, we're reaching them, and then by design, by knowing who we're reaching, we're going to help craft our message to make it as attractive as possible.
Right.
You can't change your position, but you can talk about it in a certain way, in which we'll brief the president and let him make sure he knows what's on their mind, so he can kind of play to their interest and speak to the issues that they're concerned about. And you typically wouldn't put them in a hostile environment in which they're getting questions about things they don't care about. But what we have found is that if you, in these unconventional forums, of news forums, that they tend to be conversations that are more personal and more kind of, like I said, they're not so focused on politics and on process and things like that, who's up, who's down, and it's more about what do you think about this and why.
I was thinking in the Clinton administration, they had done polling, and they knew that it was unpopular to for the U.S. to be providing help to support the peso in Mexico. But the president decided to do it. But what they were able to do through their polling is, and the polling that others had, was have an understanding of what people thought the arguments were, and that there were some arguments that they could find that were more popular than others. And so how they presented it was going to be important. And even though people were against it, they had some understanding of what the public thought, and then to try to move them. But recently there was a conference at Texas A&M in which there were a lot of papers presented dealing with the whole issue of whether a president can change public attitudes, and the presenters uniformly thought that was not the case. And so I wonder what your experience is. Are there cases where you've moved the public, or are you thinking rather than the whole public, individual publics? Because it sounds like you're targeting to individual publics.
I think there are. It depends on the issue, but you're right. You'll have more success focusing on a constituency, a more manageable size constituency, as opposed to the mass public. It's interesting. Sometimes when you talk about an issue that not everybody may support, what it speaks to is a broader value or a broader messaging point. An example of that is, and I think both in substance and in broader message, for example, when the president first ran for, when he was governor and ran for president, he made a point out of making education a top priority. Now, and it came out with a very detailed plan, which ultimately passed. Now, whether the public specifically knew every detail of that plan and supported every detail, it probably not. And we probably weren't successful in penetrating in that level of detail. But the broader communication point we did was we made people sit and pause and say, this is a different kind of Republican. We don't expect a presidential Republican candidate for public to be talking about a federal role for education. So that was a communications goal in which we said, you take an issue and you show the president, you show his passion about it, and you talk about it, and, you know, all the time. And obviously you hope to form a majority opinion on that, and I think we probably accomplished that as well. But it even had a broader messaging point of communicating a broader value of this president or personality, is that he is a kind of a different kind of Republican. And that was one of our, after what we felt was some of the messaging limitations in 96 presidential candidate Bob Dole, is that we had to show that this time around in 2000 that we've had a different type of Republican, and that's one of the reasons how we used an issue to do that. another issue that I think that we've most recently experienced that is very difficult to communicate because there's such passionate views about his immigration mm-hmm. and the president's position on his immigration proposal. And many members of his own party don't like it. Mm-hmm. And we've tried different ways of communicating it and saying it and telling what it is and then what it's not. And we've seen polling on this. We didn't commission any polls, but there's a lot of public polling on this mm-hmm. stuff. And there's just going to be a climate in which some things you're going to be able to successfully communicate it or not, and uh-huh. that shows a challenge, one issue that which a real communications challenge, despite how many times we say it or how we say it.
Yeah, and that's really been true in most administrations. Immigration is a very tough policy that Congress stays away from it, and that usually it ends up having to be the president that that pushes it forward.
Yeah,
and it usually is unpopular. Where does the president himself come into communications? What does he think of the importance of communications as an aspect of his leadership, of his being president?
Oh, he thinks it's critical, and he has very good communication instincts. Oftentimes, I've oftentimes got the call when he'll say, "Let me tell you how you're going to do your job this week," and he'll give me very specific instructions. But I meet with him. We have a daily message meeting with him every morning mm-hmm. in which we go over what's in the news, what we're trying to accomplish that day, if any audibles need to be called.
What's that?
Oh, if something's in the paper, for example. If uh-huh. something happens and we need to address it, or if mm-hmm. there's been a bombing in the Middle East or something like that, does it require him to have to make a statement? Those type of things. Do we need to add something to a speech? Those types. So we have those meetings every day with the president, the vice president.
What time is it?
It varies, but it's usually right after his intelligence and mm-hmm. his briefings right in the morning. Mm-hmm. And it's the president, the vice president, usually, if he's there, the chief of staff, and, mm-hmm. Dr. Rice. It started in the war. We started this because they'd have their war council briefings first thing in the morning, and we needed to know when they came out of that meeting, okay, this is what we're doing now. This is kind of, they've been briefed about what's going on in the military side of mm-hmm. things, and they had to kind of communicate that to us on more of the messaging side to make sure we were all synced up. So that's kind of how it started, but then we've just kept it as a standard practice to meet with the president uh-huh. every morning.
In choosing to have news organizations embedded with mm-hmm. With various troops, was that a White House decision, and who was involved in it? Did it reach the president's level?
He was briefed about it. Mm-hmm. But it was more kind of informational. I mean, mm-hmm. I guess if he didn't like it, he could have brought a halt to it. It was really Tory Clark, who was head of public affairs for the mm-hmm. Department of Defense at the time, came and briefed us on this idea. We had some questions and interacted with them on kind of working out the kinks of how it would operate. But the premise of it, we liked and thought was a good idea. I think we never thought it was going to be as successful as it was from a technical mm-hmm. standpoint. We were convinced that 48, 72 hours into the campaign, into the military campaign, that they would have lost their technological capabilities to link up. David Bloom and other reporters proved us wrong, in which mm-hmm. they were reporting from the field on a real-time basis, just phenomenal.
Yeah.
It was plus and minus. I mean, it was a net plus, don't get me wrong. The plus was the public was getting emotionally invested in what was going on because they felt like they were there. Mm-hmm. And then, so they were emotionally getting invested in what our soldiers were doing. I think there was a distant feel to the 91 Gulf War because the press were left out. They, mm-hmm. the press were kept back. And they couldn't, so it looked like an arcade game. It didn't really even look like a war or feel like a war because you didn't see it or feel it there with them. And in this case, it was much different. I mm-hmm. mean, you saw what they were going through on a daily basis. From a communication standpoint, though, the challenge was there was so much original content coming from the field, there was no context. Mm-hmm. So if it was your habit every morning to wake up and watch the Today Show, and watch David Bloom and the Bloommobile go firing across the desert every morning, you woke up and it's like, here goes David Bloom, he's going like a bat out of the hell, and he's kind of traveling and talking, and saying how, you know, I forgot which brigade he was with, and we've covered 300 miles in 48 hours, and we're going. And then the weather hit or something, and they stopped. And they had to sit there for 72 hours. And the commander for this little brigade didn't know why, but the general was telling him, you stay there, hold down. Well, all you got was David Blum coming in and was, well, we still haven't moved. And then he reports again, well, we haven't gone anywhere, and they're dirty, and he's all sitting there, and there's like, well, and all the guys are kind of shooting the bull and kind of hanging out, and, you know, and you're sitting there saying, well, why, and then all of a sudden bogged down. Well, it must be bogged down. Well, David Gregory, and they're not, David Blum's not moving, or, you know, we must be bogged down. And not knowing that there was a whole lot of other activity, whether it be special forces or other people going on, in which there's a lot of activity going on. And like I said, somebody said it was like viewing the war through a straw, because you're only seeing one little, because if you got associated with one of these embeds or a couple of these embeds, you were only getting a thin slice. And the whole Schwarzkopf model from 91, in which the general came out and told you what was happening, since the press was there seeing to themselves, they didn't have to rely upon these briefings and didn't, because they were confirming things in the field quicker than the command structure could confirm them back to the general who was briefing, because they were seeing it real time. But, you know, the military, they have process. If there was a KIA or killed in action, they had to go through a process of verification, but somebody's right there reporting it, saying, I know it happened, it just happened. So they would reel it back to Cutter, to their reporter there, and say, we've just learned that there was a bomb that took out, you know, three tanks or whatever, and they couldn't confirm it. So you had this big disconnect between those who were trying to give context to it to those who were in the field reporting it. So I think that was the challenge of it, but in total, by no means it was a real success for the American people, for the press, and for our administration.
Did you all get together and talk about it and look back and see what things you did that you thought went well, and how you might integrate some of the things you did?
We did. One thing we were doing it real time, trying to find out how can we better provide context. How can we give more relevant information to these generals who were briefing the press at the headquarters? The challenge was, Tommy Franks was the ultimate un-Schwarzkopf. He didn't want to be the briefer. He didn't want to be out there. He didn't want to be a star. He wanted to do his job. So our one guy who could really break through and come out and put things into context did not want to go out in front of the cameras. And that was a constant struggle for that. But, yeah, we came back, and I know not as much the White House, but DOD Public Affairs did a huge deconstruct and got feedback from press and things about that. And it's obviously a much different situation now, because the press it's a free country, so they can go where they want and report what they want.
Yeah. I notice news organizations are having their own embeds in the political campaigns.
They've taken it to a new level.
Let's go to some questions. Towson, do you have a question?
Okay. You outlined some interesting and successful media strategies to promote President's positive image here at home. And I was wondering, is anything similar being done on the international level? Because I know that President Clinton used to travel, for example, came to Bosnia for a number of times for the opening of President's monument, and story of a number of times, which I think did leave a long time positive, I mean, it created positive benefits for the troops in U.S. troops in the region and the third whole region, because it was reported so widely. And President Bush doesn't think he travel a lot, and I don't see a lot of being done on the international level to promote his image. So how would you comment on that, and what do you think?
Well,
can you translate?
Yeah, that's right. It breaks up. It's like a satellite dish when a big storm is coming. She is from Bosnia, and Clinton came through several times, and so her impression is that the president traveled a great deal more abroad that Clinton did than Bush did. And so, what are the ways in which you try to project what you're doing internationally?
Well, two things. One, in presidential travel, we have. It's been a little bit of different style. The president would go overseas for the same period of time that President Clinton would, but we would visit more countries for a shorter period of time. He would stay longer. most of that has been dictated by the fact that for the majority of his presidency, it's been war, been a mm-hmm. time of war, and he's not had the luxury to travel extensively overseas. Security situation is different in mm-hmm. that regard as well during a time of war. But when we do travel to a country, we do try to do some things that help demonstrate or show a side of him or communicate a message that that they may not be exposed to. The idea is, though, is in the global communications office that we've created is over time become more sensitive about what is being reported overseas in particular countries and what we can do strategically to better shape mm-hmm. or inform our position. And a good example of that, particularly in the Middle East, and it's something that Margaret Tutwiler, who's in charge of public affairs now and public diplomacy at the Department of State Department, but she was ambassador in Morocco, is that we've become too reliant upon our old methods of communication with foreign countries, and that is government to government. Our government will send a cable to our ambassador will talk to their ambassador will talk to the head of state, and we'll try to communicate something, or we'll put out a joint communique or something. Well, particularly in the Middle East, many of the mm-hmm. people in those countries don't like their governments at all, and they don't trust what they hear from their governments, and we've got to find new ways to talk to them, mainly satellite TV. And we're starting a new Middle East satellite network there, mm-hmm. And internet and other types of aspects. So we need to fundamentally change the way we're communicating to foreign audiences to just like I do here in my job, as we've talked about, mm-hmm. I find Field and Stream and Bassmaster and other ways to reach constituencies. We got to find those unconventional ways overseas to reach people. And it's not going to happen overnight, but we're trying to get some structure in place in our government to recognize that and start acting on that in order to better communicate so people understand and foreign countries have a better understanding of what America or the president mm-hmm. Is all about.
In the case of global communications, how do you know what it's doing, how it's working?
That's a little bit tougher. We do monitor what's going on through our embassies. They're supposed to do reports about what's being reported, editorials, newspaper articles, what's on cable. We have people who are monitoring Al Jazeera and things like that, mm-hmm. and they feedback that to reports to us. So it's more difficult, and that's one of the things we're trying to work out is what are the metrics in which we're going to judge ourselves.
Mm-hmm. So is the State Department that looks at Al Jazeera, or do you have people at the White House?
And both, uh-huh. Global Communications Office as well.
Okay.
We have a Middle East expert.
Larry?
Dan, this has been great, really fantastic. I have two questions. I'll make them brief. First, could you characterize for all of us your assessment of the reaction to President Bush's the recent use of the 9/11 mm-hmm. Images. I'd be interested to know what your reaction is to the criticism of that. Secondly, I'm glad you mentioned David Gregory at least three times, I think, today. Martha knows from previous conversations I consider Gregory, this is not attributed to you, but I've often characterized him as John Kerry's communication director. He has, in my opinion, he has lost his objectivity. And so I'm really curious to know if you could characterize what you would assess as to the bias in perhaps the White House press corps, if you believe it exists. My scholarly friends like Martha suggest that perhaps it's a function of the fact that the administration might not be as easy, might not give information as quickly and as easily mm-hmm. as previous administration do, and therefore it's frustration. I, however, view it differently, and I'd like to see where you fall within that, and you could perhaps educate all of us. Thanks.
That's a minefield that I have to carefully dance in. Let me take the first one. There's no secret that campaign ads are just like any ad done by any company or any candidate or any politician. You focus group them. You make sure that mm-hmm. the audience is going to be receptive to it. Those ads were tested to make sure that from a sensitivity standpoint and from a messaging standpoint that they're going to be successful. Why spend millions of dollars on something that's not going to be successful? It would be foolish not to. The idea that that 9/11 in itself was supposed to be, quote, off limits, we felt was a false test. I mean, it was something that a limitation that I don't think any American would think that, that the issue of 9/11 in our response or the response of others should not be a part of this campaign and be a part of the debate. It's a part of who we are as a country. But the question was, could it be done in a tasteful way, in a way that was not exploitive, but done in a historical way? And if you look in the ad itself, it's just very, it's glimpses of it. It's not the president trying to take credit for anything. He's literally not in the ad. His name comes at the end, but he's not in it at all. It's not the bullhorn. It's not that. And my first judgment, my first reaction was going to be, I would know in the first hour after we aired the ads whether it was going to be a problem or not. And it wasn't, because the reporters, we had 80 reporters who went over to watch the preview of the ads. I don't know if you went over for that.
No.
80 or so reporters went and watched it, and none of them walked out with any impression other than these were good ads. Maybe somebody asked the question, well, what about the use of, but not one of them really came out. It was only until some of the organizations, you know, coordinated a response, the Firefighters Union, who's supporting Senator Kerry, did, as well as a very vocal victims group called Peaceful Tomorrow, which is a part of the victims' families who don't support any military. They didn't support Afghanistan. They didn't support Iraq. They didn't support any military response to the acts of 9/11. But it's a very emotional issue, and it's one that we knew that it was going to cause, that there were going to be some who were opposed to it, but we thought in total, because of the testing we did, because of the it was going to be appropriate. But and then the press is just doing the process story. As soon as the Senator Kerry and others were willing to criticize it, then it's a he said, she said thing, and they're going to cover a process story like that. But it's interesting. I also would say, just to tell you the nature of the electorate and the nature of where our country is divided among party lines, I can honestly say I bet at the end of last week, our team sat down and said, we accomplished our goal. We're talking about, you know, the ad accomplished its goal. We're talking about it. We probably got just as much in earned media as we did in paid media,
right,
because of all the coverage that was given to it. So expanding upon the people who saw the conversation about 9/11. And then I bet John Kerry's people were sitting around at the end of the week saying the exact same thing. We accomplished our goal.
Mm-hmm.
We had to get them to defend their ad, and they had to do this, and they had to explain to the victims' families, and we got the chance to get our firefighters' unions out there. So there's going to be times where the two campaigns engage on an issue, and both are going to come away thinking they won that issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that just goes to the nature of the electorate right now, and particularly in the parties, how opposing views they have on some of the most fundamental issues before the country. On your other issue, it's interesting, because I think, maybe that's just because I'm so close to it, I think David Gregory is actually one of the least, has the fewer violations compared to some of his colleagues. I think it's motivated by, I don't think it's a partisan bias. I think some of most journalists who cover us are probably come from a Democrat or liberal persuasion, but I don't think they come in saying, I want to attack the president. I do think it's more motivated by careers. Mm-hmm. And I think every one of them wakes up every morning saying, how am I going to get my pretty little mug on the nightly news? And how am I going to get to be the lead story on the above fold page for the Washington Post, New York Times, LA Times, whatever it may be? They're motivated just like all of us in our careers. They want to be the best at what they do. And in order to be the best, to be on TV, to be the lead news story on the nightly news or on the Today Show or above the fold on the New York Times, they've got to be provocative. And sometimes persuading their bosses, their editors who are producers are sitting in New York or here in Washington, they may have specific views of this president or not, and they may be persuaded if David pitches to say, I want to do a piece whacking the president's tax cut. And I think it's more career motivated than it is a partisan bias.
Yeah, you could say of the network news, three network news programs, two of the three anchors had served as White House reporters. Mm-hmm. Dan Rather and Tom Brokaw were both White House reporters. Okay, do we have a question from Towson?
It's kind of obvious. That you all don't really like hard questions. Are you glad by using unconventional media you avoid the tough questions? You know, Dayton, Ohio TV anchor isn't going to ask the same thing that Tom Brokaw would. So is that one of the goals you have?
Okay, I got part of it. Say, somebody from a Dayton, Ohio TV anchor, is he going to ask different kinds of questions from a White House correspondent? Is that it?
Yeah, well, you go after the conventional media. Obviously, Rush Limbaugh is not going to ask questions to Colin Powell. Is that part of their goal, is to avoid the hard questions?
Hmm. Is that for, you mean for the talk, for the talk radio?
No.
Are you talking about...
Are you suggesting that a local reporter is going to ask the difference between a local reporter asking tough questions and whether it will be a, the reason why we focus on local reporters is they don't ask the tough questions that the national press will ask?
Is that one of the goals you have? You're trying to avoid those questions.
I think what I see the goal in if let's say, for example, the president travels to Dayton, Ohio, or press or somebody in the administration, not only are they going to ask questions that are more focused on substance and less on the kind of the politics or process, but they're also, their news organization is going to air in entirety the entire interview, whereas at the national level you're going to be more inclined to be subjected to editing and slicing down to which they just take a sound bite or two, which not necessarily would take out of context but may not give a complete explanation. And local regional reporters, they could ask some of the most difficult questions, but at least they're going to give you a venue and have the airtime to give the complete answer. But to that end, in 2000, I think one of the most damaging interviews the president did when he was running for governor was from a local reporter in Massachusetts, in Boston, who did the pop quiz on what foreign leaders you knew and the names, and the president couldn't name a couple guys, and that became fodder for weeks. So they're just as capable of asking tough questions. In fact, sometimes they have a better ability to stump you because they'll ask some arcane local issue which you may not know all the answers to.
Probably in that case, say for example, Tim Russert would not have asked that kind of question because they assume that there are always going to be questions like that somebody is not going to know.
And somebody's trying to get famous real fast. So I'm going to get the president here or whoever and make a name for themselves. So both are ripe for problems or for not accomplishing your intended goal, but both are equally important to deserve equal attention.
Well, in the president's recent trip to Ohio, I was talking to somebody who, a political scientist, who was doing some on-air, and he sat in the studio during the time that their coverage was on, and he said their coverage was on from the time that the president arrived to the time he left.
And it's live coverage, wall to wall, from the time that Air Force One stepped.
Uh-huh. Is that normal?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
It is.
So you get a lot more than whether the anchor, you get the president himself.
That's true.
Yeah. One of the things I was thinking about of the press corps, one of the frustrations of the White House beat is that people who come to the White House beat are people who have been in other beats that have had entirely different rhythms and dynamics. So if you're on the Hill, you're talking to the vote every day. There are 535 members of Congress, and you can get to them very easily. And there's stories all over. So you're used to having information, just a full plate. even if you've been abroad. For example, Maura Reynolds was one of the people who has spoken with us, and we had her talk about covering Russia, because she was in 6 years in Russia, and the kinds of things that she could do there. And so I think in some ways the frustrations that one sees in the briefing room are the frustrations of being held in a very small area, particularly when one's plans for the future may be larger and have had a different kind of beat coming in.
One of the biggest difficulties is when we get a when a new correspondent for the White House comes directly from the Hill, Dana Bash, Nora Donnell for MSNBC, others, because they got sources galore up there. You got 535 people trying to make a name for themselves and stick out, so they've got people falling over them, each other trying to get on news or get access to these people. Mm-hmm. And when they go down the street to the White House, it's a little bit different. We're mm-hmm. he's the president. We know we can make news. We don't have to try to stand out. We can right. do that. And there's it's a different culture which they have to deal with. I'll say one thing was kind of interesting. You go to bias or you go to influence. The New York Times, their influence on television and on the reporters is unbelievable. When I was in Texas and during the campaign, they would, when the New York Times would put their news story up on the web, they put it up about, I guess it was 9 o'clock, our East Coast, it was 10 o'clock, Central Standard Time, literally to a, like clockwork. With my wife used to sit there and say, I'll give it 3 minutes before the call. It was some big story on the front page in the New York Times. And every single network morning show was calling saying, who are you going to put on to respond to the New York Times? I mean, it was their marching orders. I mean, their ability to shape television news, particularly on foreign policy, but even on domestic policy as well, when shaping the television news mm-hmm. is unbelievable. And if you just do a little project, I bet if you took 1 week's worth of news, take the front page above the fold New York Times stories for 1 week, and I guarantee you at least 60-70% of the network evening newscasts, either ABC, CBS, or NBC, will do a story on the above fold page New York Times stories.
Mm-hmm. In the Clinton administration, they found that USA Today drove on certain kinds of stories, particularly stories appealing to the boomers.
That's true.
And so computer technology, medical stories, mm-hmm. Those kinds. That so they, in addition to dealing with the Times.
That's true. USA Today, though, I don't think they drive the networks as much. But they get a big readership. Mm-hmm. The challenge I've always found with, because you see the way USA Today's formatted, they're short stories with a lot of pictures. It almost looks like you're watching TV. And the problem is they don't give a lot of ink. So mm-hmm. if you're trying to explain initiative or something mm-hmm. like that, they don't give you a lot of room to explain it. So mm-hmm. You lack context. But if you get good placement and all that and you get a good picture and a good headline, mm-hmm. it's worth a lot.
What did the Post and the Wall Street Journal drive?
Washington Post, in my opinion, is all about inside Beltway politics and process stories, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. If there's one issue I think they're trying to distinguish themselves on in the last 18 months has been the intelligence issue.
Uh-huh.
They have dedicated more time and space and resources to that issue than anybody else, in my opinion. But in large part, I think they're very much they're a Washington-based newspaper. They cover politicians. They cover the process, the twos and pros, mm-hmm. and what makes news. Obviously, in the Wall Street Journal, it's more market-driven, economy-driven mm-hmm. issues that are more important and impacts directly on the economy.
Mm-hmm. Okay, do we have here? I think we've kept Dan pretty much a little longer than we anticipated, so we'll take two.
Hi, yeah. I'm actually a journalism student, and I'm writing a paper on a lot of the recent articles that have come out about especially the one in The New Yorker entitled Bush's Fortress, about how there isn't that much information coming out of the White House. Mm-hmm. I don't know if this goes back to what Larry asked, but if maybe you could comment on these articles, columns that these journalists have been writing, just regarding the lack of information that's coming out, how they feel that Scott doesn't give them enough information during press briefings, something along those lines.
Yeah. Yeah, that was an interesting piece. There's that piece in the New Yorker, but there's a broader one in which I think there are, what you're finding is a mixing of two issues. One is media access and getting information from the White House, which is in itself is one issue. Then the second issue is the secretive White House, and you hear about the Energy Task Force, or you hear about 9/11, you know, this commission, that commission, and that's more of a legal issue. But a lot of times I see them get thrown together, the secretive White House, they don't give access, they don't want to do this, they don't want to do that. And they're fundamentally two different issues, but like I said, they get put together. The press is, they're never going to be satisfied with the level of access they get. Is our access different than others? Probably. I don't think the press briefing room is a good example in the sense that the cable news has changed the nature of the press briefing, in my opinion, quite a bit. Now, there were some others who were able to do it. McCurry, I think, for example, was very good at still being informed because they're on live TV. And so they kind of have a – not only are they responding to reporters' questions, they've got a lot of – they've got an audience out there that are watching, and you're communicating a message to them. And sometimes there's a tension between those two goals, you know, a communications goal and a responsiveness to the press goal. Our goal is to – as much as possible, stay on the messages we want to in a press briefing, and then try to get those questions answered off the podium and away from the camera. And sometimes we're successful at that, and sometimes we're not. And the techniques of the press secretary are important because a situation can get out of control in which it gets a sense of you're not giving us the answers, and they pile on, and it's like start feeding off each other. I do think where we get the Bush discipline thing more than anything else is – I really think we have a combination of people working for this president that from both people who have been with him for a long time, like myself, and other people who came from Texas who were up here working with him, integrated with some Washington-savvy people but are loyal to the president, who are not in it for themselves. They're not in it for making the names for themselves. What I found, not only in the Clinton administration, but in Bush 41 and others, there were real divided camps within the White House. And they litigate their differences through the press. The press loved this. I mean, because they were the sources, so they would get, you know, inundated with information from people. And we don't find that to happen as much. Now, we're not immune from it. I think probably the most obvious kind of public kind of to-ing and fro-ing you see is between the State Department, Department of Defense, Rumsfeld versus Powell. You hear about that all the time. But actually within the White House, you don't get that as much. Our Secretary Carr, our chief of staff, he worked in the Reagan administration, and he said when there were meetings in the Roosevelt room, they would literally put you on the side of the table, whether you're a Baker guy or if you're a Meese guy. I mean, it was that obvious and overt of you know, camps within the White House. So the Meese guys would leak something from the meeting, and then the Baker guys would go out and counterspin it and do this, and the press were fat and happy living off all this. All this constant, you know, this kind of to-ing and fro-ing. But again, it does get back to an issue that, you know, Martha's talked a lot about and I've recognized is that can we set up opportunities for the press to learn more about what's going on? I'm also, it's, you know, there's a deliberative process that has to take place in which the president's making policy decisions. And if parts of that information gets public, it sometimes skews or puts pressures on the type of discussions or decisions he can make. But it's something we're constantly working on. We don't run a perfect operation. We could probably be better. And always looking, like I said, last week was an opportunity for us to give some reporters some background information. Mm-hmm. And in total, it was a good thing, and it worked well. But even that showed the problems we had by it being reported and things like that.
If you look at Republican administrations, look at the Eisenhower administration, the Nixon administration, Reagan administration, and you all, there's some enormous similarities in the way that information is coordinated, and it's coordinated at the top, and so that messages are developed, and the persuasion operation, then the communication persuasion operation is front and center. And then the information operation kind of works off of that. You know, you provide the information that you want that relates to that particular message. And that was true in all of those administrations. And in Democratic administrations, it seemed quite otherwise, that they don't organize in the same way. So that, in fact, there may be just similarities between Republicans and the way they manage their White House. So it's not just a communications thing. It's the way
would you
that
also
they
say,
organize.
Would you also say, I think it would be proven that Democrat staffs for White Houses have more of a personal, and I don't want to use the word chummy, but they have a better personal relationship with reporters than Republicans do.
Yeah, they, you can say in some senses they come from the same gene pool. That, for example, Franklin Roosevelt, you can see in his press conferences, he really enjoyed reporters. He enjoyed having them around. Theodore Roosevelt did as well. But the ways in which they organize, it depends on what kinds of people. You could say the Democrats bring in people who have an interest group background, so they come in with strong policy positions. And so there's much more of an incentive for them to be leakers. That in both Clinton's and Carter's case, they came in after long periods of Republican rule, and their constituents had a very broad agenda of what they wanted them to do. And so the new president then spent part of the time at the beginning listening to them, that they didn't organize the same way at the beginning during their transitions. And so they did that organizing after they got there. And so all these interest groups wanted to get in with what they wanted to get in. And so you just have very different kinds of people. So that perhaps what Republican administrations bring in management people and people with an experience of coordinating as well as an experience with the president himself.
Well, that's his management, yeah. His management came into.
Let's try one last question from Towson. And I guess try to get near that microphone because you're breaking up a lot.
After Bush is reelected in November, are there any good changes that you're going to make in the Office of Communications that you've learned over the past 4 years that you could make better in the next 4 years?
Well, I agree with the presumption. basically, she is there anything if reelected or when reelected, as she said? Is there things that we learned from the first term from a communication statement that will change from a second and going to second term? The access issue, I think, is one thing I'll probably work the hardest on. Mm-hmm. From that standpoint, I think the biggest challenge is going to be is a talent drain. You know, people who've worked for the first 4 years and trying to cycle people in, particularly speech writing, I found to be the hardest place to find good speech writers. Really, really difficult. It's a difficult, difficult job. We've got 6 full-time speech writers that work for the president around the clock. I found that to be probably we've had the hardest challenge. But I think probably the access issue and trying to find a way to let the press and the president have a more personal relationship. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much, Tam. Really appreciate it.
I want to take one more. He was one of the first person.
Well, the president has proposed his Immigration Reform Act as something as compassionate conservatism, homeland security, to help protect the homeland, and so on. And then on the opposing side, they kind of spun everything around. I guess my two questions for you is pretty much after the spin on the proposal, does the president feel that this Immigration Reform Act is going to pass Congress? And if, you know, as it is being presented right now, or is he going to have to make another spin on it? And so do you know what that might be?
Even non-controversial pieces of legislation are going to have difficulty passing this year, to be frank. Election years are very difficult to pass anything. We'll be lucky to get a budget passed, to tell you the truth. Mm-hmm. The nature of the division in the Congress, as well as just it's in an election year, like I said. Put on top of that an issue like immigration, which is incredibly controversial, a lot based on misperception, is going to be very, very difficult to get done this year. We're going to continue to work with Congress to hopefully get it passed. But this will be something that, if it doesn't get passed this year, the president will continue to make a priority in his second term as well, because he really feels, it was just struck by how much the coverage of his proposal was analyzed in political terms. An election year, the president going after a key constituency, Latino vote, did this. And let me just tell you, if I were advising him just on politics, I would have told him to stay clearly away from this issue. It's not a winner from a political standpoint. But that's not why he did it, because he's a former governor of a border state. You know, he was the first national Republican leader to come out against Prop 187 in California in 1996. I mean, he has a history on this issue, because, and he's seen it. He grew up in Midland, Texas, which is near the border. He knows that there's almost a double standard here in America. We want us to have sealed borders and act like we can keep everybody out, but at the same time, we want to have the benefits of what illegal immigrants bring to our country, and the way that we work, and the type of work they do that maybe legal Americans wouldn't do. And he just feels passionately about it, and that's why he said, I don't care. We obviously had to delay the proposal after 9/11 to make sure we assess our border strategy, but he thinks it's a rational, sane, humane system. But in a political environment we're in right now, this can be very difficult. We've had a difficult time communicating that. I'll be the first to admit that, and it may take for this campaign year to get behind us before we're able to get it done. We're going to continue to push the hill, but...